Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And we need to continue. I'm hoping, folks, that as we discuss this and as we... I hope that actually having some deep, detailed conversations regarding the Constitution can actually help you realize the kind of government we were given and what we can do with this government now that we live in a world that's a little bit different. And actually, Sean, let me kind of bring you into this because it's kind of with the obligatories. Every once in a while, I'll dive into the, you know, the learn, pray, act type of thing, but I'm hoping that people don't look at the Constitution as some debilitating or some complex rocket science type of thing. They created a compact that created this creature called the federal government, and that federal government's job was very simple. That government's job was to protect and defend the sovereignty of the Union, as well as the sovereign individual sovereignty of the states. It was the states' job to protect the liberties and sovereignties of their individual citizens, which is one of the reasons why the states managed their own immigration. They basically had responsibility of how they were going to govern themselves. And so you could freely move from one state to the next if you didn't like their theocracy or however they decided to, you know, create their republican form of government. And so I know we were kind of talking, and it kind of lends into this, but before we get into where we left off on Friday, let me get into this. I think that people learning and starting to realize that if we had the ability as states to really work together in managing domestic issues, then we would actually be so much more productive, so much more efficacious, so much more ahead of the world. Now, I'm going to talk about one little topic, and that's education. I'll throw this in here because I mentioned this, I think, last week, that education is a completely different subject. It needs to be completely eradicated. We live in a time in a world where, you know, the framers could not even fathom virtual governing. We live in a time where our rulers, our presidents and the rulers of the world believe in real-time governing. They do it because they prosecute wars that way. And they are literally using real-time governing to govern us. And it needs to be reversed. The state should be governing real-time. They should be governing that federal government and reeling it in. Had this concept been available, I believe that the Senate would never have been created as a physical vestige. I believe that the Senate would actually be the state legislatures working together, so when the president put up nominations, they would all form their own little committees. You know, whoever got appointed by the state legislature, to, hey, you go work this appointment for the judiciary here. And if you think about it, when you get a new president, you could actually get a lot of this crap through very quickly. Does that make sense?
That's the first thing I thought of. It would make things so much more fluid.
Absolutely.
To get things done and execute things.
Absolutely. And now we would be dealing with actual state suffrage instead of globalist suffrage, because the globalists have been the ones trying to maintain and keeping the people who meet their agendas up there and getting them in. And I'm going to tell you, our Supreme Court would not look anything like it today, except for, I think, the one guy that deserves to still be there would be Clarence Thomas.
Amen.
Everybody else has fell short as far as I'm concerned. And if the states were actually looking and talking about, you know, the Constitution and compliance to it, I mean, you know, nobody's perfect, but I even think Clarence Thomas would even be a better Clarence Thomas if we were doing things right. And I just think that these other ideologues, especially Roberts, would never have gotten onto that court.
And as a matter of fact, I think that there's a lot of people that wouldn't be citizens today in the United States. But anyway, education. So we have the ability to have the best education in the world. And as a matter of fact, we could actually offer the best teacher to every student in the United States. In other words, the best math teacher could be in every classroom because it would be virtual. I believe that this concept of having an army of ideologues in these private little room settings with your children to basically pollute their minds with their perverse ideology has been what's destroying us, and that's been destroying us. And I remember when I was a little kid, how cool it was. I was hearing things from the teacher that my parents didn't agree with. And boy, it seemed like I was getting the truth. And how they lied to me. And by the time I graduated from high school, I was ready to go vote communism in. And I'm saying that a little sarcastically, because I was actually raised a little bit better than that. But I will tell you that I was a Democrat supporter because of the way the teachers had influenced us. And even G. Edward Griffin goes, yeah, I mean, he graduated in the 30s, I think, or 40s. And G. Edward Griffin basically said that when he graduated, he was a little communist as well. The education system has only gotten better at creating little communists. And in other words, better because they're not converting as fast. You know, it used to be that as soon as you graduated, you started converting back to capitalism and these other ideologies that, you know, basically conflicted with it. But bottom line, when you have the best math teacher and it's actually all virtual, the only thing you need is to have a tutoring, you know, an online tutoring assistant that can help you with the process of how to, you know, work out factoring and math or whatever, geography or literature, those types of things. My point is that we spend way too much money in employing teachers. Way too much. Look at how many teachers we have. Did I ever bring up yaymath.org to you?
Yes, you have, and I checked it out. It's awesome.
And there you go. I believe that guy can teach every kid in the United States that speaks English. I think he can reach them. I think that America, as far as math goes, that guy is the bomb. And I think that if you bring forward such stellar teachers, I believe we'll have even more stellar teachers because somebody else is going to build on or innovate and come up with even better ways of teaching these principles to kids virtually, that we could actually start having a level of competition. But doggone it, why is it that we're buying into the fourth class system that we've got? And we're spending all this money because the federal government knows that as long as they can control it, they can control us. And it's that simple. So this, folks, is we kind of cover this content. We kind of, you know, help you start seeing the his DNA, our creator's DNA in this Constitution, and how it is still something that is so relevant for us today. That all we need to do is unleash the power of the states on domestic matters. The Constitution didn't even fathom, the men in the Constitution didn't even fathom that government on domestic issues would get that involved, that they wouldn't fathom the need of having a shared roadway where they would actually be paving and actually, you know, creating airways where we could, you know, get to a point of destination very quickly. I think that if we really look at our infrastructure, I think one of the models should be, or one of the tenets, or the credo for the Department of Transportation is, it's our job to make you, to help you, you know, commute or travel at the fastest, most efficient way possible that you choose to use. In other words, if you're going to drive a car, then they should have a roadway and a system that will allow you to drive at breakneck speed. At the optimum capacity of that car, that they could create a system of doing that. I mean, I've always thought that, you know, how, what do they call those tubes that you put that thing in and it goes from one point to its destination. Hermetic or sealed or what have you.
Oh, but okay. Back in the day, you didn't drive through, yeah.
And so there's got to be a way that they could probably do that. But I honestly believe that the real thing is about freedom. The whole point of travel is to be able to travel at your own pace and your own way. And so if the infrastructure, you know, is going to create a system, then they should actually be able to create a system that would not be giving us roundabouts, that would calm us and slow us down and make your commute longer. Government has no business of creating more tax to your time to make you less efficient. I think that there needs to be a symbiotic relationship, and those people who, you know, can't drive or unable to drive in the conditions or what have you, but we need to really start thinking out of the box. I do not like the concept of corporations, you know, managing our information or controlling us either, because corporations are governing bodies as well. And corporations have become entities or tools for government. When you look at Amazon, and everybody thinks Amazon is this independent company, they've been giving your data to the CIA since their inception. So this is how the government has been bypassing, at least the federal government, has been bypassing having to worry about spying on you, because they've got all these companies that are more than happy to give them their information, because they're all about controlling you, and they're all in the game to control you. Control your movement, slow you down to basically report on everything you're doing, and they've actually created algorithms and everything else to predict what you're going to do. This all has to be broken, and this goes back to the states and from a bottom up, how do we want to actually, you know, traverse the union? Do we need to go by air? Do we need to go by rail? If you, you know, do you have to have rail systems? The point is this, that I know there's a cost to everything, but I know right now with social engineering and the trillions of dollars that they spend on socialism, we would have a top-notch infrastructure for us to be able to traverse on our own, to be able to do and travel on our own. And I just find it repugnant and just absolutely infuriating that we've got a government that has basically been able to get away with assuming all of these ridiculous powers that they don't have and wage warfare against us. So as we get educated, as we're going through the Constitution, I'm praying that more of you will actually start saying, wow, you know, I wish I would have taken more attention sooner, but now, GR, you've got my attention. And actually, it's not GR. You know, you should be thanking the Lord that, you know, I'm helping you get his attention or your attention to him and what he's given us. Maybe that's a better way of saying it, because that's the whole point here. This is something that gives us the ability to actually create enlightenment. You know, John Adams made the comment that the Constitution was made for righteous people. I believe that it was made for, people that believed in liberty, because as I look today, was the Constitution made for them back then because they were righteous, or was the Constitution made for us in the state that we are today because we're less righteous? That's a question for you, Sean. I'd like you to, you know,
think there would be both.
I believe that he knew what we were going to need, what we would need in these days. They didn't need much. They were already, they lived in a time where their blessings were pretty simple, and they were very thankful, and they had a great relationship with their Creator. I believe today the Constitution has become that real godsend to where we can actually see how this one document can get that iron-fisted thug's hands off of our necks. And so I believe that, you know, we can't just say that the Constitution was just for anybody. I believe anybody that has an open mind, that can see, you know, the beauty in liberty, then you actually possess what's innate, what God gave every person innate, the desire of liberty, to be able to choose for yourself. Because that right there is everything. You have to choose for yourself. You can't be forced into salvation. You can't be forced into living a better life. So anyway, right, wrong, or indifferent. I mean, if you disagree, that's fine. Go ahead. I'm okay with anybody.
I absolutely agree.
Okay.
It just makes me think about everyone that I've heard when I do my scripture studies and things like that, like people like Frank Turek and different Chuck Missler. That's what it comes down to. It has to be free will in order for it to be of God, because that's the way he set things up.
Right.
You know, if he made a perfect world where we didn't have to do anything but sit around and enjoy his blessings, then we would never appreciate it. We wouldn't know the difference between good and evil. And I think that's how it ended up happening.
Yes. And so what you basically said is right on cue with the whole concept that we all have to be equal participants in this system. I mean, if you want to be able to choose what you're going to eat, who you're going to marry, and how to raise your children, if you want to be able to have access to information to teach yourself and make the best decisions for yourself, then this is the system here. That's it right there. And so there's a lot of people that get this. But unfortunately, we get caught up and say, no, I don't like the way you think. I don't like what your faith is doing. I tell people all the time, you know, which faith, because there were multiple faiths in America when the concept, you know, the revolution and all of that, God didn't pick one faith and just bless one state. He blessed the Union because what they did was they put aside their differences of faith. They put aside their differences of labor and commerce. They put aside their self-interest on the concept of liberty for all. And that right there is what we need to do today. We need to put aside all of our differences and be able to work together for those who love liberty and want to pursue liberty for all. Then there we go. So, all right. Now, on Friday, you made a comment that we were kind of going into the end of the song, or the end of the music kind of kicked in. And what you were talking about was this concept of corporations making money, and with states and governments saying, you know, if we don't use the budget that's given us, then we'll get less next time. The military has done that as well. And it kind of cut out on you as far as what you were saying. So I don't know if you wanted to kind of finish that, because that right there perpetuates evil. As a matter of fact, the culture that you were talking about is everybody else does this to get ahead. I have to do it too. And we all kind of become, you know, willing participants in wrongdoing. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So did you want to magnify?
I'll reiterate what I was speaking about. Okay, I was talking about a long time ago when I first started getting aware of what actually goes on with the government and
how things are
not the way they should be. That I found out that they had come up with a new process to use rubber pellets from used tires to extend the interstate to where they wouldn't have to maintain it as much. But the companies refused to employ this method because it was so much less. It reduced the cost and reduced the need to service the highway, and the highway lasted longer. And the states didn't want it because if they didn't spend all of their money for the highways, then the next time they appropriated, they would get less.
Yes.
And it was just like a blatant, like you say, it's like a Ponzi scheme. It's just self-perpetuating corruption.
Yes. Yeah, the old self-licking ice cream cone. So we were going to start talking, and I think you made a comment about oaths that you wanted to bring up as well.
Right. I heard several people who are, I'm not going to mention their names, But talk about the oath that the president takes being different and unique, because it contains the word preserve. And a lot of people use that to excuse or give extra power to. And on one hand, it makes a little bit of sense because he's the only person who's elected by all of the people. And he's like, I would think he would be the last line of defense if we're invaded or whatever. He's the CEO. He's the commander in chief. So I really had a question about whether and what the founders had to say about that in their discussions in the historical record about the president's oath containing the word preserve, where none of the other officials or representatives.
Yeah, so why was it different? Why was it different? And I don't know if it was different just because it seemed more eloquent and for the pompous position of a president. as a matter of fact, I think I had this commentary a long time ago that if there was a way to create a board of, you know, like a board of directors to where an executive body wasn't just an individual, because in those days it was all boiled down to one person had to, and I believe that the commander in chief is definitely needs to be at least one person who has the ultimate say, because there's points in time when a decision has to be made. As a matter of fact, I have, you know, in the military, I've dealt with a lot of different people. I've heard a lot of people analyze, you know, the differences of leadership and tactics and so forth. And I'll just share this with you as an aside, that in the Marine Corps, we have aviators, officers that are aviators, and we have officers that are ground pounders. And it became, you know, right, wrong, or indifferent, it became very evident to me that when you needed a decision to be made instantly, what are we going to do? The ground pounding officer would be able to give you a boom, this is what you do. Now, the aviating officer would actually be, you know, looking and trying to process all the different calculations in their head to give you the most accurate decision, because they wanted to make the right decision. And 9 times out of 10, the decisions you get from the ground pounder is accurate. The question is, the time is everything. Sometimes if you hesitate on the decision, people die. I mean, that may not happen in business, but in war, it happens that way. And so ground pounders, they live based on those realities where, you know, pilots and aviators, it's all about the planning and you know, and they get the term is paralysis by analysis. In other words, all of a sudden they're given a problem. They start analyzing the problem instead of making the decision. And so this is why when you have a board of directors, all of a sudden there's way too many players and so forth. So I would venture to say that there's probably a better way of having an executive instead of allowing the, let's say, the you know, the personality of a person to become, you know, the chief executive of everybody. And because I think we've seen where we've had some, you know, some president where their personality is just, it rubs some people the wrong way, and it, you know, rubs other people, they just love it. You know what I mean? Bill Clinton was one of those guys. Our current president's one of those guys.
Definitely.
And so I don't have a solution, but I do know the corporations, because they have the ability to think and slowly articulate, you know, how they can make the best decisions and come off with, you know, the right decision 100% of the time. I think that there's a way to possibly do that. But when it comes to war and the commander-in-chief, that shouldn't be on the table of an, you know, paralysis of analysis. And so I don't know how to improve on what we've got, but I will say this, that, you know, there are ways because of technology and so forth, and I would never inject AI in anything in government. As a matter of fact, I would actually ban AI involvement, because I truly believe that, you know, we've got to do these things on our own, And we can't compete with a computer, nor can we compete with any foreign intelligence. Anyway, we'll be right back after this promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so we've kind of taken the whole first segment and kind of caught up with some things from Friday and other concepts that I've introduced. And I forgive me, folks. Bottom line is it's all about compliance of the Constitution. Now, if we kind of ran everything to its own volition, Sean, or is there something else? Because I don't want to stifle comments or ideas. And so that little pause was probably, guess what? Sean was muted. And so anyway,
yes,
there we go. There we go. All right. All right. So,
no, I think we're good, sir.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's dive into Article 2 and start off with Section 1 and this very first line here. Go ahead.
The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States, and he shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and, together with the vice president, chosen for the same term, be elected as follows.
So let me ask you a question now. The executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. Does that constitute that there is special power in the executive, or that the executive, based on the Constitution, has very specific powers in his roles, responsibilities, and duties?
See, I think it's pretty plain that he is to execute, have the power to execute the Constitution.
Okay, so that actually comes later, because when people see the word power, because if you go up to the very beginning to Article 1, it says right here in Article 1 at the very top of the Constitution, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in Congress of the United States. Now, technically, there is a power that the president has that is legislative, that's not mentioned here. And I don't want to try to confuse anything, but the reality is when we come down into the veto power of the president, this is where the president can actually function in a conflict or a contradiction, because government is a sovereign power. When we create a government, we delegate to that government the ability to govern us. And if we give them general powers, then we've basically given them access to our lives, house, family, you know, all of our property. I mean, we've given them everything. And that's why the framers said, we're not going to do that. We're going to give them very limited powers. So this power of legislative power is basically framed to those objects that are listed in Article 1, Section 8, underneath the preamble, right? And so if you go through the color-coded constitution of enumerations, I really help drive this home. that the only very few places where the federal government or Congress has the ability to make any laws regarding matters. They can't make a law regarding the apportionment of people. They can't make a law regarding, you know, how old a representative has to be. It is etched in stone and firm. The only way those things outside of Section 8, and they can't change the language of Section 8, they can only make laws in pursuance to the powers given, such as the you know, to make a uniform rule of naturalization. So those are the laws they create, the laws regarding and a uniform law of naturalization. I'm just trying to help people understand that the power that is in the federal government, they see these words power, that usually implies, you know, grand things. The president actually has legislative powers, but it is only a negative against the legislature. Guess what? Okay, without waiting for the response. So guess what? The rhetorical question stands as this. The Supreme Court has no negative powers at all. The Supreme Court's job is to rule on a case of a controversy. In other words, a controversy between one person and the state, or a controversy between two states, or a controversy between the United States and a foreign body. Their job is to look at the law, look at the Constitution, and say the Constitution has vested these powers or has not vested these powers in the federal government. That means the federal government can't do those things. Period. In other words, as a matter of fact, before it even goes into a ruling for them to even choose, the Supreme Court and all federal courts should have this litmus filter. If I had my way, it would be like a computer process that case could not go into a federal court unless it had very specific parameters. In other words, it was a case that was directly arising underneath the Constitution. Because they only have jurisdiction over things arising under this Constitution. That's it. So the point is this, is that when we see the words power for the president, you know, most people don't think that he actually has a unique power, but he actually does. Or they think that that power is like a king, and no, he doesn't have that. He has limited, but he has power. When you go to section or Article 3, you'll look at the judicial power shall be vested in the Supreme Court. So they're using these things kind of as a term of grandeur, that the Supreme Court has these things. But when you actually look at the judicial power shall extend to all cases, that's actually in Section 2. And with the power of the president, it gets into the veto. The court cannot veto any law. They can't make law. They can't change law. They can't redefine the law. They can make rulings, and it says right here, they have the ability to make these rulings, but they have to do it based on law and fact, not interpretation, not case law, not precedents. That's why none of that is listed in Article 3. So back to Article 2 and Section 1. So the president has this, believe it or not, he has this power, this very unique power, not like a king, but he has the ability to tell Congress that that law is not going to fly. Here's this little comment. I believe that this should actually have a change to it. I believe if the president identifies a law that is a direct violation of the Constitution, then that law cannot be overturned with a two-thirds majority. What do you think about that?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
At the moment.
All right. So the point is this, is that when Congress, you know, what am I going to do? I'm going to veto it. They're going to overpower it anyway. The concept of the Constitution, they couldn't think the Congress would ever do that. They couldn't think the Congress would even come up with, you know, laws that would be violating. And actually, the president, in executing the laws of the Union, right? In other words, Congress can only make laws in pursuant to the Constitution. So if they're trying to create a law, let's go with an act, the Reapportionment Act, where they're going to basically start changing how many people that they represent. And it's their decision to arbitrarily make that number up. And so now that's why they represent a million people and they become an oligarchy. And so the president could actually go in and say, hold on here. You don't have the authority. That the Constitution did not give you the ability to just make that number up. To change that, you need an amendment. Therefore, you know, either you start getting people in here that are representing 30,000 people, or you bring an amendment that the states are going to buy off on. And then until you do get the states to ratify that amendment, you better get people in here representing 30,000 people. See, the president has that power. And as a matter of fact, when the president, here's another power that the president has in executing, because his job is to execute the laws. And so if Congress came forward with an unconstitutional law, let's say you had, you know, a massive group of Democrats in both houses that actually created a law like, let's say, the ADA, tried to create a law that would inflict controls and regulations upon states regarding disabilities and tell them they have to behave a certain way and they're going to come in and regulate and enforce these things. Well, that's not an enumeration within the Constitution. Technically, the president would have the authority by using the Department of Justice and go in and remove every person that voted for that bill and who brought that bill up. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
In other words, we shouldn't have to say this, but we actually have to, that Congress cannot entertain any law that would directly violate the Constitution, that would definitely violate those powers. If it's not within their powers to create that law should never be entertained. And the person that tries to bring forward that law has directly violated and committed rebellion against the Constitution. And for trying to do this, or for trying to bring this in, this is how we cut these things at the chase. I mean, we end this at the beginning. See my point?
I do.
Okay. So there are...
That doesn't happen. So you're saying that the president has that power now, since it's his responsibility to enforce the law?
So
the Constitution is the supreme law of the land.
Okay.
So the president could say, Congressman, whoever you are, you're, you know, trying to pass a unconstitutional law, and you're by the 14th Amendment, you should be removed.
Yeah, see, there it is. So George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Adams, all the presidents up until Ulysses S. Grant, right? So all the actually John Andrew Johnson, the vice president took over. So once the 14th Amendment was ratified, then the onus actually did go to the president to actually be able to make sure that no public servant who was under oath could ever violate their oath. And when they did, if they violated their oath while in office, in their capacity as a politician in their job, like creating a law, like what you just stated up or set up to say, okay, he could do this? Absolutely. Since Section 3 changed the language of the 14th Amendment of holding people accountable, and it actually, as we clarified, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is not a due process. It means you're no longer eligible. So the question is, does the president have the ability to enforce eligibilities?
I would think so.
Absolutely he does.
Wow.
If it comes out that you're sitting in office and you're no longer eligible to occupy that office, and you're not stepping down, he has the ability to remove you. The states have the ability to remove you as well. They're just not enforcing the law. If this has become such a giant, what do you want to call it? There's some really bad names for it where we talk about these, like a RICO.
I can think of a few.
Well, so there's these, I'll call it a crime syndicate or what have you. This honor amongst thieves has gotten so far. Yeah, there you go. Because we've gotten so far out of hand that everybody is afraid to be held accountable because they know they've got some bones in their closet. And the only way to break this is say everybody gets a first and final, except for those who have been directly waging an insurrection against the Constitution openly. In other words, AOC, you're gone. Biden, you're gone. Obama, you're gone. All of these people, based on, well, technically the presidents don't fall under Section 3, but they should be impeached and then tried for treason and then punished for treason. And so the Constitution demands that every public servant support it. Even though it is unique to preserve by the president, it doesn't matter. As Madison stated, the people that are really supposed to make sure that what's going on in the federal government is in line with how the Constitution was sold and defined. So what matters really is this, you know, the states opposing every infraction, which is why Madison stated that in the Kentucky Resolution. So when we get through the Constitution and get into that, we'll actually tie that into this to say, see, the state legislatures, they're the ones that are duty-bound to oppose every infraction because sometimes the president won't. But the president has the power to do it. You know, we have so many checks and balances. To me, it's a beautiful thing. Okay. So let's dive into... Now, what we're going to do is you notice we have pink, and then we have red with yellow text, and then there's a section below it that's all italicized that's yellow text, right? You yes, see sir. This? This is a part of Article 2, and you'll notice that that big paragraph with that's italicized tells you that this language right here has been changed by the 12th Amendment. Now, this is the first time we've hit something in the Constitution that the language has actually kind of really, really changed. And so, and we've done this, but we've never really, let me see, hold on here. We had actually Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, right? Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, and modified by the 10th Amendment. Congress shall be assembled. Okay, so, and actually that does have the italicized. What I need to do, because this modified by amendment, 14th Amendment, Section 3, up above, and I think I've got a couple places of that, modified by the 17th Amendment. So I need to go and italicize those words. But the problem is that the words themselves only apply to, which they should have actually helped, you know, clarify. Let's do a go back real quick. If you go to Section 5, each house shall determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and the concurrence of two-thirds expel a member. Somewhere in here, because they have to determine the rules of proceedings and punish their members, right? They have to do this. So in other words, they now have to apply Section 3 of the 14th Amendment as a part of this process, but they don't need the two-thirds to expel a member. Right. If a person has been identified, you only need a majority of the people to agree that, yes, you have violated your oath, you're gone. Because it doesn't require a supermajority. The only reason that they put that in there was to make sure that partisan politics would not come into play to basically punish one person because they're supporting slavery or something else that's all within the Constitution, right? Because they knew that they would be divided between slave states and non-slave states. And so they wanted to make sure the partisanship was not going to be able to become, this factor in punishing and playing these types of games. But when it comes to supporting the Constitution, that's a cut and dry thing with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So, like I said, this is one of those things that actually should be italicized. So when we go back to Article 2, Section 1, the question is, and I usually read this and then I read the 12th Amendment. Technically, all we really need to do is read that first line, and then we need to read the 12th Amendment. Does that make sense? Or that first paragraph. instead of reading that whole paragraph that everybody's going to read because it's all been replaced. The only reason that we read this is the fact of the minor change that has occurred. And so we got 8 minutes to go into this. And actually, as you notice, we've got this interesting little thing now that's purple with yellow. So what is, or pink, I should say, pink with the yellow text. What does that mean?
That means that violations caused by amendments to the Constitution are in pink background with yellow text.
Right. And so the question is, what amendments to the Constitution have changed? And actually, I'm trying to think about this, and I'm not sure if this is correct. I may need to go back to Paul, because as I look at the 12th Amendment, the 12th Amendment isn't violating this, that each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. I think that this goes back to the 25th or 26th Amendment, because I believe when you look at the District of Columbia being able to choose electors, it's an amendment that actually violates the Constitution, because Article 1, Section 10, or not Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 17, should actually be highlighted, and I don't think I did. No, I didn't. So what should happen is, actually, it's Section 16. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district. When you look at what happened in the Organic Act, we kind of talked about this before. I'm sorry for digging, and I hope this is not confusing you folks. When you're looking at the color-coded Constitution, we identify these violations that are created, and then I'm trying to remember how this, how an amendment is violating the Constitution. And as I look at this Section 16, or Subsection 16 in Article 1, Section 8, that does need to change to pink, because the exercising of exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over the district, give me some latitude here for a second, because I'm just trying to get all of this stuff correct, because we're going through this with tying them to the violations and so forth. And I think it is right here, the rights of the citizen to vote in the primary. Let me find the district of, here it is. It is 23. So go to Amendment 23. Okay. So the district constitutes, I'm going to read this. This is the 23rd Amendment. The district constituting the seat of government of the United States shall appoint in such manner as the Congress may direct a number of electors of president and vice president equal to the whole number of senators and representatives in Congress to which the district should be entitled if it were a state, but in no event more than the least populous state, they shall be in addition to those appointed by the states, but they shall be considered for the purposes of the election of the president and vice president to be electors appointed by a state, and they shall meet in the district and perform such duties as provided by the 12th article of the 12th Amendment. Basically, this right here, this amendment, violates the exclusive legislation period. Because what it did, and I think we got to go ahead of this, I think there was another amendment that talked about the District of Columbia. So let me, forgive me folks, I don't mean to do this, the district. So, I'm going to go up there, and actually, we're going to do a quick search, and let me see if it is before or after. I want to say it's got to be after, maybe. because I think they tried to expand. Yes, they did. There was another proposed amendment that was not passed, and it was proposed in 1978, and it was never passed. But this is where they tried to seal the deal, where what they did in the Organic Act was create a local government where Congress abdicated their duty and responsibility. The District of Columbia was to never be treated as a state. The people that lived there would never have representation. So in other words, if you lived in the district, you did not get the privileges of living in a state. The district was federal land, and it was to be controlled by Congress, and Congress could not be electing their own, shills to come into the Senate or get involved in, the choosing of the president and all of that, to help pad their numbers in any way at all. We went through this in the ratification debates, how this concept of maintaining this no man's land that would not have representation, would not be a state. That's why they carved it out the way they did. I believe that what should happen is, because they created this, I believe the District of Columbia, which has already been seceded by, did you know that Virginia has taken back their land? Did you know that?
I heard something about that.
Okay, so Virginia took back their land. They allow the federal government to own the buildings that they use, and any property that they want, they pay for, they buy, and they put up. Then the state legislature basically has to agree on any new construction, and so forth. And they have bases that are already still a part of Belvoir and all these places in D.C. around the area of these old bases. Cameron Station is another one. Anyway, so as we kind of look at Maryland, Maryland should take back that land. Maryland should basically say, okay, the people that live in Maryland now you will be a part of Maryland, and you will have your representation with Maryland, and make D.C. literally no longer the seat of government. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does.
Because the fact is that they weren't to be, possessed by a state so a state could harass them. I think maybe we've gotten to the point where that's not a problem, but what we've done is we've created a condition where these people feel that they're entitled to become a state. And it's almost like creating the Vatican. And that, we're going down a very dangerous path. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's already, look how bad it is now.
Yes.
The president had to call in the National Guard to deal with the crime.
Okay, great. So let me say this. In the next show, because we're out of time, in the next show, what we're going to do is I'm going to have you read the first Article 2, that big part of the Elector's Clause, and then we're going to go through the 12th Amendment, and I'm going to ask you tell me what the differences are between the two. And so I'll send you some paperwork to kind of make it easy for you to do this. So that way we can kind of go through them so that we can actually follow the old curriculum, so that you will be able, in your own words, to say, well, hey, I think the 12th Amendment only does this. And it's really minor when you think of all the words that they had to inject to make the change. That's the difficulty of an amendment that goes over these little minute details, literally minute details. So anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help, and we'll be getting into the Electoral College in our next episode. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract
and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.